Welcome to Practically Political. It's great to have you back. I'm Dave Spencer.
And I'm Carrie Sheffield. Let's get right to it. We've got a special guest here today, Charlie Sykes. You've seen him on MSNBC. You've heard him across airwaves all over the country. Charlie, you are such a well-known voice here, and we're excited to have you on Practically Political.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
It's great to have you. Great to have you on the show, Charlie. So I guess I was going to ask you, inflation is the big stumbling block, it seems, for Biden. And he seems a little tone deaf about it. Every time people ask him, he's like, oh, the economy is great. And I heard a stat that two-thirds of the voters in this election will have never experienced inflation. And it's really hitting him hard. And if anyone should be able to remember, it's Joe Biden. But he seems kind of tone deaf on it. What do you think? And what should he do?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, there's very limited things that the president of the United States can do about things like that. And this is, of course, one of the things that, you know, both parties tend to exaggerate their ability to solve problems like this. But in terms of being tone deaf, I think when they rolled out the moniker of Bidenomics, it was perhaps, you know, not the most forward thinking strategy that they had. And I think there's a certain amount of denialism about it. And I think the denialism has to do with people who have the whiteboards and say, no, you're wrong about inflation. Look at these numbers. And of course, people in their lived realities are walking into grocery stores and seeing it every single day. And the fact that it moderated in its growth doesn't change the fact that things are just far more expensive about this. So this is, you know, one of the, you know, significant challenges that he faces. I think there are other challenges as well. I would think that inflation and the border would be two of the biggest negatives that he has going for himself. And I think that it's very, very difficult for him in the short run. What he's got to hope for is that the economy remains robust, that people begin to pay more attention to those jobless numbers, look at their 401ks, look at the stock market, and at some point get used to the fact that their groceries just cost a hell of a lot more.
Yeah, and also it was a little complicated by a slightly higher than expected inflation report last month, which led the Fed to say that it probably most likely won't cut rates in June. And then, of course, it could cut rates in September, but then Powell might be open to the criticism that he's trying to help Biden win. And you even have Larry Summers saying, people like that, there's a 25% chance that the Fed may raise rates. So I don't think that's going to happen. But if it does, Biden is toast. And so it makes it a difficult situation.
Well, I mean, that's part of the problem of inflation, that higher interest rates make everything more expensive. And so that's part of the picture, that people are seeing that things, you know, buying a house is more expensive, cars are more expensive because of the interest rates. So it is difficult. The big question that I have in my mind is whether or not the 2024 election will be about the economy. Remember, we're all old enough to remember, you know, the old slogan, it's the economy, stupid. I'm not sure that the rules of the game are still the same as they were back in 1992. There are going to be so many other issues on people's minds. And I think it has to do with a more holistic sense of, is the country headed in the right direction or the wrong direction? Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Biden can make a pretty good case that we're better off than we were 4 years ago, but the mood is sour. And my sense is that it's probably going to be even more sour by the end of the year, because I think we're in for a kind of a rough summer and a rough political campaign. It's not going to put people in a good mood, is what I'm saying.
No, I think it's true. But to respond to what you said, I think that the MAGA crowd is certainly still going to vote and be loyal to Trump and vote more on issues of culture. But I do think that the swing voters are much more susceptible to the economic message. Carrie?
I agree with that. It's interesting to look at a range of the issues that voters care about, and they care or they trust Donald Trump more on pretty much every major issue except abortion. So on everything else, which includes economy, it includes foreign policy, it includes national security, it includes immigration, voters trust Donald Trump more, this is according to the Wall Street Journal, than they trust Joe Biden, except on abortion. So I'm going to be watching to see how much the left, and I'm on the press list for the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign, And the drum is always beating from the Biden campaign about abortion, abortion, abortion. Charlie, do you think that's going to be sort of the trump card, if you will, for Joe Biden on abortion?
Well, I think that Donald Trump thinks it is. I mean, that's why he did that flip-flop on the question of abortion, I think, in the last couple of weeks. The problem, of course, is that Trump's new position that it's really not about saving the babies, it's about states' rights, kind of puts the pro-life movement in a trick box, or actually puts Republicans in a trick box, because they own, of course, all of the state legislation, including what's happening in Arizona. And yet at the same time, Trump's rhetoric does in many ways throw the pro-life movement under the bus by saying, you know, whatever you decide is okay, whatever best for you and for your family. And you see how that manifested itself with Carrie Lake, who had been a staunch pro-life candidate just a couple of years ago, now saying that, well, no, you know, we don't want to be so, you know, we basically, I mean, her most recent ad could have been cut by any pro-choice Democrat. So I think that Donald Trump thought that he was neutralizing that issue, but abortion is one of those issues that you just cannot neutralize.
Yeah, well, that you also mentioned the border, and that brings me to my second question. I was talking to Jim Messina, who ran Barack Obama's successful 2012 re-election campaign, and he said if he were running the campaign, he would literally rent a place on the border, have Biden go down there, and every day go, because Donald Trump said when he blocked the best abortion bill that Lankford and Murphy put together, that he blamed me, right? And so he would go down there and say, well, this is where we want to build more detention centers, but Donald Trump won't let us. This is how we want to deport more people, but Donald Trump won't let us. This is how we were going to, what would benefit if we reformed our asylum laws. Donald Trump won't let us. So it just seems, you know, look at what happened on Long Island to George Santos's former seat, right? You can take on the border and win. So why aren't Democrats doing it more?
Well, I don't know they can win on the border, but maybe they can cut their losses on the border. And I think you are going to see that sort of thing. In fact, I was watching some of the debate over the foreign aid bill that was the Ukraine-Israel bill. And of course, you know, one of the talking points from the Republicans is that we're spending all this money on you know, foreign wars, but we're not securing our border. And the Democrats, of course, push back and say, could I remind you that, in fact, we did have a bipartisan piece of legislation that was crafted by a very, very conservative Republican, Senator Lankford, and Donald Trump torpedoed it. So that's going to be part of the ongoing conversation. But it's hard for me to imagine Democrats actually winning this particular issue, but I think that they have a counter at the moment, but we're 4 years into this issue and, it's going to be front and center for the Republican campaign.
Yeah,
I agree. Well, on that, speaking of that bill, I love to hear your thoughts, Charlie, on this effort to potentially remove Speaker Johnson over the spending bill. I'm on the email list for Russ Vogt, who was, head of budget OMB under Trump. And now he's one of the lead architects who he said what's happening is that Mike Johnson is breaking his promise, because he said before assuming the speakership that any Ukraine funding would be contingent on closing the border. And he said he's breaking his promise because we don't have the border funding. And so he supports the move to oust Speaker Johnson. Do you agree that he broke that promise? And what do you think is going to happen if he does get removed again?
Well, I actually find what's happened over the last 48 hours while we're recording this to be quite extraordinary. I mean, number one, you had this, Mike Johnson getting religion on Ukraine, recognizing that this, in fact, was an existential threat to the left. It was also extraordinary to watch how many Republicans were willing to defy Donald Trump's opposition to this bill. And when the rule came up in front on the floor of the House of Representatives for this foreign aid package, it passed with more than 300 votes. I think it was 316 votes. So you have this huge bipartisan coalition in favor of all of this. Now, you know, part of the disingenuousness of people like Russ Vogt is, of course, that You could have had the border bill, but you know, he and his MAGA buddies killed it. So you can't. It's a little bit like, you know, the you know, somebody who goes in front of the judge and you know, at, you know, on charges of murdering their parents and, you know, pleading for mercy because they're an orphan. You guys killed this bill. So I hesitate to use the words profiles and courage, because these guys will always disappoint us. They will always break our heart. But Mike Johnson stood up there and said, okay, you know, this is the right thing. He knows that it puts him on a slippery path. He knows that it might cost him his job. And he chose to do the right thing. Now, he chose to do the right thing after months and months and months of letting Ukrainians die because the weapons were drying up. But he did it. So at the moment, we are in this rather remarkable position of watching a quasi-coalition government. And it's kind of a flashback to what Congress looks like when it actually wants to not be dysfunctional, when it doesn't want to be directed by clowns like Matt Gaetz or Marjorie Taylor Greene, when they're serious about getting things done. Now, that probably won't last, but they took a break from dysfunction, and people like Russ Vogt want to put them back into dysfunction. I mean, if you really, really want to screw up the Republican Party, let's spend the next 6 months showing how uninterested they are in government by having a chaotic House of Representatives. Real men of political genius would plunge the House into that kind of chaos.
Well, my hope actually is that obviously the Ukraine bill passes because it's desperately needed. And I still don't, you know, we're not even talking about people like J.D. Vance, but that there is MGT or one of the clowns does put up, or Massey or one of those people does put up the motion right to vacate. And then Johnson has to rely on Democratic support to stay in power. And then, as you say, Charlie, then I think it's going to be mandatory bipartisanship, and there's a chance that more can get done.
I think that's the likeliest scenario at this point. Now, I mean, this is messy for everybody. I mean, Democrats are not going to want to save Mike Johnson. On the other hand, for Mike Johnson to lose his speakership because he did the right thing, I think would be an unfortunate picture. So, again, we're in uncharted territory, and that's the story of 2024 over and over and over again, that anybody that tells you exactly what's going to happen this year is making that up, because there's no historical parallel. There's no historical model that you can say, this is the way this plays out. And certainly what's happening in the House of Representatives. Now, you know, I mean, you know, part of this is just the math that Republicans now have, what, a 2-vote margin?
Well, I think
with the resignation of my fellow Wisconsinite.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say after Mike
Gallagher. Yeah. 2 votes.
Wow.
So given the number of Republicans who are utterly uninterested in actually serious governing, either the House of Representatives grinds to a fault and returns to complete, you know, clown car dysfunction, or they come up with some sort of a bipartisan way of muddling through the rest of the year. And they can perhaps do that because I don't think that there's a lot of prospect of major legislation for the rest of the year. If they get this package through, that, you know, Democrats could perhaps throw a lifeline to Mike Johnson without necessarily giving anything up. But again, I don't know when we've seen anything like this, anything remotely like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And go ahead, Gary.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, to your point on Democrats probably will not step in and save Mike Johnson, even though he did something good for Ukraine, because they didn't do that to Kevin McCarthy last year when Kevin McCarthy, he pushed forward the bill to keep the government open to avoid a shutdown. And did the Democrats reward him? They rewarded him with the chopping block. So I don't expect there to be any love lost or continuing, I guess, from the Democrats for him. But I guess my bigger question is, because
we'll see,
there's this, you know, there's this specific fight on Ukraine and Israel and immigration, but I'd love to get your thoughts more broadly on U.S. debt overall, because we're now approaching almost $35 trillion in U.S. debt. And unfortunately, it's mind-blowing to me. Our U.S. debt interest payments are now $1 trillion annually. And a lot of it has to do with the hike in the interest rates that is spiking the borrowing cost for us. To me, this seems like a complete fiscal train wreck. And I understand the impulse by some on the right to want to stop the spending. To me, it seems they're more, they have a bone to pick about Ukraine. I have a bigger bone to pick in general about spending. Do you support actual fiscal restraints? Do you support, I mean, do you think there are any grownups who can stop this fiscal train wreck?
Well, they haven't so far. So I think that the default setting would be no. Republicans talk about the deficit except when they're in charge. And this is one of the, look, the last 10 years have been, you know, this soul-crushing, disillusioning experience. And back in the day, in the before times, when I was on conservative talk radio in the state of Wisconsin, one of my very frequent guests was Paul Ryan. And probably 100 times, we talked about the looming debt crisis. And this was the most predictable crisis facing the country and the ruinous implications of that much debt. And then when Republicans had control of government, what do? They jacked up the deficit even more. So you have the spending problem, and then you also have a revenue problem. And so I'm not sure what the Republican plan is other than to cut taxes even more deeply. And I actually like tax cuts, but at some point you need to look at this and say, you know, how much debt do we really want to add on? This is the greatest intergenerational transfer of wealth in history. And quite frankly, I don't see much seriousness on the part of either Republicans or Democrats to deal with this.
Well, and I would just add, you know, entitlements, no one's willing to touch them. And that's 75% of the budget. And so with the debt ceiling fight that happened almost a year ago, it was basically over 1/6 of the budget, right? Because now defense is off the table. And plus a quarter of our debt has to be refinanced in the next 12 months. So that's going to make it worse. So by 2025, the interest on the debt will pass Social Security as the biggest expense. And again, I don't see any effort in Congress by either party. You know, it's the old saying that all politicians love to spend. The Democrats just admit it. And I think that that's what you're seeing here. So I don't see how, unless there's someone that comes in with significant political capital and in such a closely divided country, I don't see how it's going to happen. I don't know.
Well, and of course, this is the problem, that you're not going to be able to tackle those issues without some sort of a bipartisan approach to it. You know, in the past, when they've tried to do it, they would come up with bipartisan commissions. And the reason they do that is nobody wants to jump off this cliff without, you know, alone. And one of the great innovations, of course, of Trumpist Republicanism when Donald Trump came along was when he announced that he was not in favor of any of the kinds of entitlement reforms that people like Paul Ryan had been talking about for years. So and frankly, that helped him win the nomination. It helped him win the presidency, that he will not touch Social Security or Medicare. Now, this, again, is going to be one of the flashpoints in the election, because, of course, Democrats will try to say, don't trust the Republicans. They will try to cut it. And my guess is that Donald Trump will try to neutralize this issue the way he tried to neutralize the abortion issue by once again saying that he has no intention of reforming these entitlement programs. So there we're at. So if Donald Trump is going to return to power, it will be no entitlement reform and probably more significant tax cuts. I'm not sure how that reduces the deficit.
Yeah.
Well, I think from a language standpoint, I don't even like the word entitlement, because I don't think the only thing we're entitled to is God's love, as far as I'm concerned. But the everything else is up for debate in terms of funding. But I'm with you, Charlie. I at one point during the main stage in 2016 of CPAC did an interview on the main stage there with Paul Ryan on issues around welfare reform and poverty and conservatives' approaches to the safety net. And that's really where I think when people say, oh, I'm socially liberal but fiscally conservative, I'm just like, honey, I don't think you know what this means. You can't be one or the other. Like, there's a whole continuum of these programs that are fiscally unsustainable because you're socially liberal. And in the end, you're actually destroying the very families you're trying to benefit. That's what the research of people have shown over and over. People like Jason Riley at the Wall Street Journal, and you know, Walter Williams, The Economist. So in any case, yeah. I agree with you, Charlie, that it's gonna, I mean, that's how in 1994 with Bill Clinton, he had a Republican Congress. That's how they got a lot of these welfare reforms across the finish right. line. I don't see those type of figures today. I don't see Joe Biden going across the aisle. Is there a version of Joe Biden that could become like Bill Clinton of 94? And if so, who would be the figure in Congress that would do that?
Well, we are so far away from all of that. And you know, I think one of the big questions is, what does the Democratic Party look like after Joe Biden? I mean, I know that Republicans have convinced themselves that Joe Biden is this radical woke figure. The reality is that, you know, he beat Bernie Sanders and he beat Elizabeth Warren. And I think his instincts are centrist, but that does not mean that the, you know, the next in line will also be that kind of a person. Actually, Joe Biden in many ways was the ideal person to cut those kinds of deals because of his background in the Senate. Now, it didn't work out because, look, we don't live in an age where people value and the incentive structure does not reward compromise and that kind of, you know, governance. This would have been a moment to do that. So I honestly don't know the answer to that question. So, but, you know, what is the old adage that something that can't go on forever won't? At a certain point, there will be this fiscal cliff. There will be this moment when Social Security runs out of money and somebody has to take some action. And I think that the political class right now is just basically saying, yeah, as long as it doesn't happen on my watch, as long as I don't have to fix it, I'm okay. But sooner or later, the clock runs, right? You're going to have to figure out, how do you pay for Medicare? How do you pay for Social Security? And none of those decisions are going to be painless. I mean, I think we all know what has to happen. And I think it's doable. You know, in terms of like Social Security, raising the age and, you know, perhaps changing the benefits for people who are, you know, not anywhere close to getting it. But I don't know of, I have never really met a politician that wants to be the one who casts that vote.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you. Well, my final question is on crime. And we've seen these stats that every type of violent crime in the U.S. is dropping dramatically. They went up under Trump, yeah, and they've come down. Every type of crime, with the exception of car crime, has come down. It's really quite remarkable. And I know, obviously, yeah, crime was a big issue in your home state. That's why we're stuck, yes, with Ron Johnson for six more years, because he was able to beat Mandela Barnes on that issue. So should the Democrats run with this issue, or do you think it's too late, or what's your feeling on all this?
Well, I think they need to take it more seriously, because I think this is another one of these whiteboard issues where they will cite the statistics, but there is a sense that things are spinning out of control in some of the cities. And so this is something that Democrats like Rui Teixeira have been saying, like, look, you know, it is crucial that you not appear to be soft. Now, one of the really interesting political developments has been the backlash in very, very red and very, very blue states against progressive prosecutors. I mean, we saw, you know, a very left-wing DA who was actually recalled in San Francisco. So there is a real pushback against some of these more progressive policies. So this is something that I think Joe Biden and may need to have a sister soldier type moment. But since you've raised the issue of crime, and we're this far into this discussion about 2024, the most prominent potential criminal in America may be Donald Trump, who is sitting in a criminal courthouse in New York this week and still faces, what, 88, you know, felony charges. So, again, as part of the weirdness of 2024 is Republicans assume they can run on crime. Democrats also assume they can run on crime, particularly if the Republican nominee is a convicted criminal.
Carrie?
I want to ask you about this, because I've looked at a lot of polling around the Trump charges, And you had it obviously in the primary where Trump's approval rating shot up. It was really interesting because DeSantis was gaining ground and had a lot of momentum last spring. And then the charges started. Yeah. And then it was like DeSantis right. just started dropping. And
correct.
I think, but what was interesting in what I've seen is that Democrats and independents also, all three parties or ideologies, independent, Republican, and Democrat, all three of them believe that these prosecutions are politically motivated. The Democrats just happen to like it. And so it actually motivates them also. And independents believe it as well. A majority of independents believe that the prosecutions are politically motivated. So given that background, do you think that's part of why it's just become sort of white noise for a lot of voters that they think, well, this is just baked into the cake. He's just kind of a drama queen. I accept that. But I care a lot more about inflation and immigration. And my mortgage is now almost double the monthly payments versus what it would have been before Joe Biden took office if I had bought a house then. Do you think that people, it's just become sort of normalized?
There's the danger of it becoming normalized, but I think it's whistling past the graveyard to suggest that these trials are not going to have an effect. I mean, since you're talking about polls, and you know, I think at a certain point we do need to talk about the rule of law rather than the horse race stuff. Donald Trump Donald Trump is a man that conspired to overturn a free and fair election, who incited an attack on the Capitol, who has absconded and stolen government documents, violated the Espionage Act. Now he's in trial, on trial in New York for his many, many frauds. Now, this may not, you know, move any Republican votes, but it's hard for me to imagine that after these trials, after the evidence, after the potential convictions, that there are very, very many voters who did not vote for Donald Trump 4 years ago who are saying, now I think we're going to vote for him. I mean, I do think that there is that moment where you step back and you think, does this add any votes, or will it override many of the other things? Now, I actually think that there is a subset of swing voters, and since you're talking about polls a lot, that show that if he is in fact convicted, that it will affect their votes, as it ought to, because again, until Donald Trump came along, I don't know that any Republican would have argued that, yes, they would vote for a convicted felon for governor, for legislature, for mayor, or for any position of public trust. This is another one of these just examples of how Republicans have completely transformed themselves into these cult members that look at Donald Trump and go, okay, so back in 2016, we decided the character didn't matter. In 2024, we're deciding that insurrection and criminal conspiracy and fraud don't matter. Where does this end? And does anyone really think that this won't have a negative effect on Donald Trump in November? I think that's incredibly naive.
Well, I think it's a lot. I mean, I think the when you look at the charges as far as like with Trump and the documents, you know, the Republicans say, well, Biden did the same thing. The circumstances were very similar. The difference was that they raided his home and they didn't raid Joe Biden's home. And
well, you know that's not true.
Come on, that's such a false.
I mean, we can do the spin, but even Bill Barr, who was supporting Donald Trump, said, no, these are not the same things. When the federal government says, you have taken these documents, you need to give them back, here's a subpoena, you refuse the subpoena, and then you obstruct justice. That's the heart of this case. And again, how it plays out politically, I don't know, but they're just not comparable. And you know, we could argue about this all day, but Donald Trump knowingly, willingly defied a government subpoena. That's why they raided the house. He used his Confederates to try to cover this up. And if there's ever a trial, that will come out. Now, I don't know whether there's going to be a trial, though.
And what worries me is that there'll be a mistrial. It just takes one juror, right? And then, of course, in the New York trial, and that could be a win for Trump, unfortunately. But I wanted to end the show kind of with something fun, and that is I love what ifs. And so one of the great questions of presidential elections is, will there be a so-called October surprise? And so I guess I wanted to ask you both, if you could pick an October surprise that you would love to have happen this year, what would it be? What would it be for you, Charlie?
Well, first of all, I think there's going to probably be a surprise every single month before. There's going to be a September surprise, an August surprise, a November surprise. And the word love is doing a lot of work there. What I am hoping is that the rule of law actually steps up, that the criminal justice system actually does something that the rest of our institutions have failed to do and holds Donald Trump accountable. And the American people say, you know what? We may not be happy about inflation or the border or about spending of these other issues, but we are not going to put a criminal, a chronic liar like Donald Trump back into the White House. So that would be, I guess, a mildly pleasant surprise.
Carrie?
October surprises? I mean, all the polls say that the Americans want somebody different. They don't want Biden or they don't want Trump. Like this rematch is pretty much the worst scenario for the majority of Americans, and yet it's what we're getting. So yep. I wish we had a pleasantly surprising scenario where we had different candidates for us to choose from. But I don't see that happening. I mean, people have said, oh, at the last minute, Joe Biden, he'll drop off the ticket and there'll be a switcheroo right after the convention or something like that. I don't see him doing that. I don't see Jill Biden signing up for that, but who knows?
Well, mine would be, one of the great mysteries to me is still what happened to all those text messages after January 6th, which still haven't shown up. So I'm hoping that someone is holding on to those and they're going to be released September, October, at some point, because they have to exist somewhere. And it is just a great mystery that they never came to light. And I think they could be very damning and they could bring January 6th back into people's main vision, whereas I think it's kind of faded out a little bit. But well, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up the show. But Charlie, it's been so great having you. I hope you'll come back. I hope you're enjoying, I guess you call it quasi-retirement.
I'm spending more time with the dogs.
Good, 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 good. Well, that's great. Well, and again, thanks to all of you for joining us on Practically Political. I'm Dave Spencer.
And I'm Carrie Sheffield. Thanks so much for having us, Charlie. It's been a pleasure.